Hi, this is Mary Santora, and you're listening to The Default Setting with Jess Falstick and Elizabeth Seaman. Enjoy.
Welcome to The Default Setting, where we find out what makes you tick because we have ways of making you talk. I'm your host, Jess Falstick.
And I'm guest host, Gigi Chick.
Sorry, she wasn't prepared, and I don't blame her.
No, I was not prepared.
I didn't warn her. Today, our guest is the lovely dulcet tones of Mr. Nick Yurick. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Thanks for being on the show today. Your default setting is hoarder.
Yep.
I love it. What do you want to talk about?
Well, and this isn't just like, you know, being a hoarder in terms of, you know, accumulating a lot of random crap, which, yeah, I do that a certain amount, too. It's part of the reason it was good that I moved from a house to an apartment 2 years ago, because it forced me to unhoard a little bit. But I've also realized, you know, I tend to hoard things like emotions, experiences, and even people to some degree. Like, I mean, I've never unfriended anyone on Facebook, partly because, you know, no one's ever really done anything that bad to me, I think.
Yeah.
Or at least nothing unforgivable, but also because, you know, it's always weird whenever I'm inviting people to a show or anything, too, because I have to go through my whole friends list, and I'm like, I didn't even know that person still existed, but there's just always this scenario in my mind where I run into them out of nowhere, and it's like, oh, why'd I ever cut off contact with them?
Yeah, exactly. Like, I vacillate between, like, what you're saying, which is, like, there's no point in, like, you know, unfriending people unless it's, like, you know, a legitimately specific reason. But then I'm also, like, very much in the camp, too, of, like, if you just straight up start being a bad friend, like, I won't unfriend you in social media, but I probably will, like, sort of unfriend you in real life. And I don't know if you I don't know if you face that at all, where it's just kind of, like, you just kind of suck as a person, so you're not worth unfriending on social media, but you're definitely worth, like, not bothering with in real life.
Oh, yeah, I mean, there's people that, you know, I'll, like, stop reaching out to, or it's like, well, they're not holding up their end of the social contract, so, you know, I mean, I still, like, always keep, like, I guess that's one of the things social media is there for, is that there's always, you know, still, you still have a pipeline to that person in case things turn around, or, you know, and too, if someone, like, turns back around, starts reaching out to me, you know, I always welcome it.
Right.
I don't know. I always feel like everyone I've met in my life can still have some good part to play, which is maybe, I think that's part of where the hoarder tendency comes from, is being overly optimistic.
I love that. That's a really good way to put it. And I that's where I see myself in sort of hoarderdom whenever I've watched that, like, whenever I watch, like, hoarder shows or wherever, and they start making these arguments about, like, either the sentimental value of something or the practical potential of some type of object. Like, I always just go, oh, shit, I do that. Like, I rationalize things to that way where it's almost, like, unreasonable.
Yeah.
And when you were living in a house talking about objects, I mean, did you, was it sort of a self-conscious concern that you were becoming a hoarder? Or was it more like, no, I'm legit, like, people are telling me, like, I legitimately am becoming a hoarder?
I mean, I guess it was something that was in the back of my mind because, I mean, even as a kid, my parents were always on me about, you gotta learn to throw things away, Nick. And, yeah, like, you know, 2 years ago, my girlfriend at the time pointed it out to me, and that's part of the reason we decided to downsize, is, oh, well, this will force my hand to some degree.
Okay.
Boy, it was a good feeling, too, just purging a certain amount.
I've heard, too, like, with chronic hoarding, which it definitely doesn't sound like you are. I was at your house once, and it was very lovely, and it wasn't at all a hoarder house. Like,
oh, yeah, you didn't see the basement or my closet.
I was going to say, like, I mean, with chronic hoarding, it sounds like for a lot of people who end up on the shows to that level, like, it's almost a mental, like, I think Angelo Manage was on the show, and he was talking about how his mom was a hoarder, and she said hers was, like, an OCD-related thing, where it wasn't just so easy for her or anybody else just to take stuff and throw it out, because eventually it would, like, reaccumulate, because it had more to do with, like, a mental disability, like, inability to, like, be able to throw stuff out. So I don't know for you if you're able to rationalize it more or have other people sort of rationalize it more.
Well, it's like, people will rationalize it, and I'll be like, you know, you're not wrong, but I'm still going to do this a certain amount.
Okay. Because
it is my default setting. And
you said, like, your parents got on you about it as a kid, right?
Yeah. Yeah, my dad particularly, which, of course, it's strange. Ever since he passed 4 years ago, you know, that's kind of added a whole other level to it.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, my mom's just now getting to the point where, you know, she can get rid of some of his stuff. And, of course, me, I'm like, oh, well, I might want some of it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I'll have to gain some weight before I can fit into any of his stuff.
I know, and then I feel like that takes a turn where you're like, you're rationalizing to the level of like, oh, well, I really want to keep this. Let's put on 50 pounds to justify keeping these objects.
Yeah, it's like, well, let's see. My dad didn't really start to gain weight till he was in his 40s, and I'm 33 now. So, yeah, another 7-8 years.
And that is, I mean, it's such a good point because, I mean, you miss your dad. You have that, you know, sentimental value of sort of these things. And, I mean, do you find, like, do you personally have to have, like, a come to Jesus where it's, like, you know, evaluating what's worth sentimentally keeping and what's sort of ridiculous?
Yeah. Yeah, and, oh, gosh, one example, it's just starting to realize, you know, there's some stuff I'll never use. Like, I've had this car stereo that I meant to install in my old Subaru that the, you know, CD player didn't work in. I've meant to install that for years, and I've already traded in the car, so I definitely don't need the stereo now.
Yeah.
At the same time, I've held on to it. It was like, well, gosh, my dad got that for me for my car when I was in high school.
Yeah.
But
I imagine that's the direction I'm going to head. Like, when my parents are gone, I'm going to start clinging on. My mom's been really good. Like, I feel like, in a lot of ways, I've learned from my mom almost, like, a tendency to reverse hoarder, where I just throw out a bunch of shit that, like, I probably should have hung on to, and, like, you know, later on, someone's like, where's this thing? And I'm like, oh, yeah, I think I threw that out. Like, my mom's very much that person. I think it's almost like a skip generational thing, because when my grandma and her and my grandpa, like, they lived in a split-level house, and, like, they just couldn't get up the stairs to go to their bedroom anymore. And, like, both bathrooms, there were two bathrooms. One was in the basement, one was upstairs, and they couldn't, like, climb stairs. So it was like, if they wanted to go to the bathroom, they were fucked. And so they finally had to be like, okay, we need to get you out of this house. And so when they did, like, it took 3 weeks just to get all the excess crap, like, out of the house so that they could move them into their new place with, like, what they actually needed. And I think my mom's deathly afraid of becoming that person. So I think what she ultimately, I mean, she's worried about us too. Like, she's worried about us having to unload all of her shit, like, and go through all that stuff, which is appreciated. So I feel like it probably is hard, though, to, like, strike a balance between, like, reverse hoarder and hoarder to where you have, like, the right amount of stuff.
Yeah. Well, as I realize now, too, talking about this, I think that my dad having that attitude when I was growing up of, you know, you've got to learn to throw stuff away is partly because of his experience, you know, clearing out, you know, his dad's house when he passed. And, I mean, his dad wasn't a hoarder or anything. It's just, you know, someone accumulates so much stuff through their life. And two, his sister was a really bad hoarder. So when it came time for them to get together and just figure out who's getting rid of what, who's taking what, it was a pretty difficult process for them.
Yeah. And it's interesting to see that it's almost kind of genetic in a way, this sort of, like, instinct. And I mean, that's the thing too. Like, it does go back to, like, a vestigial thing that humans have to want to collect and to want to sort of have.
Oh, yeah.
Which I find fascinating, too.
It's hunter-gatherer, almost.
Yeah, exactly.
Sometimes like, I over-gather.
I know! And that's what I wonder, too, like, why it is that we have this need, like, once we're sort of at the limit of what we need, why we continue to, like, still, like, pile it up and not allow ourselves just to say, okay, like, we have this thing that you know, represents either this person or this time or whatever. We don't need all these other things, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of that, too, I don't know, again, beyond, like, you know, being a hoarder of physical objects, you know, some of it has to go with being a, I guess, a hoarder of emotions and memories.
Okay.
I don't know, like, through most of my life, other than, you know, periods of time when I've been drinking a lot, I have a very good memory. Like, I never forget anything, and I think that's sort of what, you know, informs it a lot, is everything is attached to something.
What's that called when you can remember, like, there's like a condition people have where, like, you can remember every day of your life. Is it sort of to that level?
Almost. I mean, I've heard of, like, very extreme versions of it where you name a random date in someone's life and they can tell you everything about it.
Yep.
I'm not quite to that point. I mean, you know, there's random things like, I don't know, October 19th, 1992, I remember a lot of stuff about that day for some reason.
But it wasn't there wasn't anything specific about that day?
Well, actually, it does kind of tie into hoarding, because one of the things I remember is, now, I was in kindergarten at the time, and I had this big box from a train set I'd gotten the previous Christmas that I played with the box more than I ever played with the train set.
You're like a cat!
That was the day my dad threw away my box.
Oh, no!
There I am, 5 years old, chasing the garbage man down. Like, what the hell are you doing with my box?
There's literally an episode of The Simpsons where, like, Marge creeps upstairs and, like, grabs, like, all this crap that, like, they don't use anymore, and she, like, sneaks out the door. Like, she did something to distract all of them, and then she...
Oh, I've seen that one, yeah.
Yeah, she sneaks out the door, and they're like, wait, what's she doing? What does she have? And they look out front, and they're like, oh, no, she's taking our shit to Goodwill! And they all run outside, and they're, like, chasing the Goodwill truck, and I think they, like, wrecked... They, like, crashed the Goodwill truck somehow so they could get all their stuff out of the back of it. This is what it reminds me of.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was. It was kind of like that. I don't know. I mean, I remember things like, watching George Bush and Bill Clinton debate on TV that night. Then, watching a Jacques Cousteau shark documentary with my brother that day. And
that's pretty cool. I mean, I think that's enviable in a lot of ways, but the thing they said about the people that have, like, the super memory is it sucks in a lot of ways, which I think is kind of what you were going to talk about with, like, emotions, because it really is harder to, like, get over stuff or put shit behind you when it's constantly fresh in your mind.
Oh, yeah. Well, and too, it makes it kind of hard to, I guess, course correct my perception of people, because, you know, again, even when someone's being kind of terrible, I still remember them predominantly as, you know, being good.
Yeah, I have that exact same problem.
You have a rose colored glasses memory?
Yeah, I have, like, very, like, visceral memories of, like, everything with, like, people and just, like, things that happened. So it's really hard, and I don't know if you find that this is the same for you, but I have a really hard time compartmentalizing.
Yeah.
Because I feel everything, and I feel it just as strongly as I felt it when it was happening or when it happened, or, you know, so it, to me, it's like, it's like too, I have too much emotion bottled up at all times to, like, ever compartmentalize anything.
Oh yeah. Because, you know, the memory is as strong as the experience almost. Well, it's like, you know, in the last relationship I was in, which, you know, lasted 4 years, it took me over a year to realize that it had gone from a good relationship to a bad relationship because, you know, the memories of the good period were still so strong. It's like, well, that all still feels very real. And that's kind of the, I guess the struggle of it is, you know, when do the new bad memories outweigh the old good ones?
Right. And that's, I mean, that's such a good point. I mean, that's a huge piece, I think, for a lot of people is, like I said, the rose-colored glasses sort of thing. And it's so weird how our brains so conveniently, like, remember bad things as good and maybe good things as much worse than they were. Like, because you have that whole, like, I think we all have that negative bias, that negativity bias, that we want to focus on the insults before we look at our compliments that we get. But then by the same token, we look at, you know, a relationship that's gone really sour, and you still are just looking at it as the same relationship that it was when it started, which makes it really hard to, like, accept, you know, the state of things, as it were.
Yeah. Well, because I think, too, like, again, this is sometimes being overly optimistic. When bad things happen, you like to believe it's just a phase.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, yeah. I mean, you want good things to be the default setting. That's why we hoard good things.
Right. That's such an interesting point. I mean, I do think that is a very perspective-based thing. Like, we had Adam Janovic on, and he was talking about, like, you know, pessimism as being sort of his default setting. And yeah. I think when the default setting is everything is bad and everything is going to shit, you become the opposite, right? Like, you kind of view everything as, like, this relationship is bad when really you just had a fight. Or, you know what I mean? Like, little things end up becoming the leading characteristic. And it sounds like when you have a more upbeat sort of positive thing, you're just like, oh, well, this is just nothing, you know, we'll work that out. And I've never actually thought of it, like, you know, as optimism potentially being problematic, I guess, in that regard, because you're not being realistic, you know what I mean?
Right. Well, and it's like, yeah, I mean, I remember my last breakup, it's like, you know, are we really going to break up just because we had this fight? And it's like, no, it's actually over years of fights, just, you know, every time we'd have one, I would go back to, okay, that's over and things are good on balance.
Right. That's so interesting. Yeah. Because I feel like in a lot of my relationships anyway, it's like both of us are just like, we have like a humdinger doozy of a fight. There's like a conversation about, are we breaking up? You know what I mean? And it's so dumb because it's like, you're right. You are just having a fight. And I feel like people are more inclined to believe that fights are like indicators of problems. So are there other instances where you hold on to like emotions, or you mentioned there were other ways you sort of hoard stuff too?
Well, I mean, I'll hold on to really awkward and uncomfortable experiences too.
Okay.
And you know, you see memes about all the time, like, you know, staying awake at night and thinking about one awkward moment you had like 10 years ago. And like, I mean, occasionally it'll hit me like, you know, should I call this person I had this conversation with forever ago and just, it's like, well, no, they don't remember it because they're not crazy, probably.
I want to get a Nick Yurick phone call at some point in my life where it's like, I'm so sorry for that awkward conversation that happened 3 years ago when we were at whatever comedy place and I don't remember it. Like, that's going to be amazing.
I don't think I've had one of those with you at any point. But,
I think we're good, yeah. You and I are always good.
Yeah. But
we've jinxed ourselves now.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's next time you're in town, I'm sure something weird is going to happen.
Or this is just going to all of a sudden take, like, a weird turn, this whole conversation, and it'll be, like, recorded, too, so you'll especially have it, like, going through your head all the time.
Oh, yeah. Well, I have that, too. Like, I'm trying to think if it's happened with any other podcast. I don't know if it's happened with any of the podcasts I've been on. Or, well, I don't know. There is one that comes back to me sometimes. This was from 6 years ago during the Cleveland Comedy Festival. This guy from Chicago had me on his podcast, and oh no, I used an offensive word at the time, and I felt like, oh, it was in context because I was quoting the people from the Westboro Baptist Church, and everything else that I said about it was obviously not in keeping with that group's views. At the time, it's like, well, those in context, and I'm, you know, quoting a hate group, so obviously... But yeah, sometimes it'll come back to me, it's like, oh yeah, maybe I didn't have to actually say that. Or,
yeah. I mean, if no one complained, then, you know, obviously. But yeah, I get what you mean. Like, I was on Chris's... I was on Pa's podcast. I don't know what was wrong with me. I think I was so high and drunk that night. And I was just like... Like, Jeremy was on there, of course, so Jeremy's yelling about, like, the Audis and the Aspies, so I just start yelling about the Audis and the Aspies, and then, like, all of a sudden, I was just like, oh my god, someday I'm gonna get famous, and this is gonna be the podcast, like, this is gonna be the skeleton in my closet that comes back, and I'm gonna get canceled, and it's gonna be terrible.
Yeah.
But then I was looking it up, and I was like, actually, Audis and Aspies is not even, like, a derogatory term, that's actually, like, autistic and Asperger people actually just... use that as shorthand, so I was like,
oh yeah,
I just assumed because Jeremy was saying it was offensive, so
it's fair.
Yeah, because there were other things. I think at one point we were yelling about why the Jews should just stay in Israel, like that's gonna get me screwed for sure. That was real bad.
Well yeah, I mean, they do control the world secretly, and well, now I'm recorded as saying that,
so. That's gonna haunt you sometime.
Hopefully people can detect the note of sarcasm there, but... Yeah, no, there's actually, too, like, another time, this was actually also with Jeremy, who actually is asleep in the other room.
Oh, and, you know, that's so funny.
So, yeah, we talk about this stuff a lot, too. yeah, it was the first time I went on, one of the late night shows on WCSB, and, you know, we get all sorts of insane callers on there, and, I don't know, the first time, there was this one guy that... I don't know, I mean, he was going on about all of this crazy alt-right stuff, and I didn't really have an argument for it, because, well, there's only so much you can argue with an insane person.
Yeah.
And that was, like, well over a year ago, but sometimes it's like, you know, I really hope that guy calls in again, and I can just let him have it properly. And
yeah.
Fortunately, with that one, I did get my chance. The same guy called in again, like, I don't know, a few months ago I was on there, and I was just in one of those moods where it's like, you know, we've been having a good time so far, and I totally had the confidence to shout the guy down. Of course, now there's a record of me, like, sarcastically agreeing with all this guy's talking.
Oh, God.
But that's kind of how I shut him up, was just through sarcasm.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, you're right. It's such a hard thing to even bother. It's, like, such a weird sort of burden we have on ourselves these days, because, like, there really is no point to arguing with crazy online, on the radio, wherever. You're also the nicest person I know, so I can't even imagine what it would sound like for you to, like, let some guy have it.
Yeah, it doesn't come out often, and, I mean, when I do, it's kind of like... I always try and put a comedic tone on it. Of course, that's something I've also been told, like, you know, in my summer job where I'm supposed to be an authority figure, like, I don't know, one of the people I work with there told me, you know, sometimes, even though you're good at dealing with people and you have to call them down on things, you tend to cut it with a joke, and
yeah. You've
got to be careful about that.
Yeah, you're, like, actually one of the nicest people I know. And it's funny it's interesting to watch you on social media, too, because even then, sometimes you can't read people on social media. Like, that's one of the hardest things, I think, is, you know, when you don't know the person, or, like, you don't know, or even when you do know them, you're not always sure, like, what they're getting at, or what their tone is, or whatever the case is. But, like, I think the few times I've seen you weigh in on political arguments, it's so, it's so diplomatic. Like, it's just kind of like, it's a very rare thing to see.
Yeah, well, that's something that, I don't know, sometimes I worry I'm too diplomatic, because it's like, you know, this person is probably just a stupid racist.
Yeah.
But then, at the same time, my instinct is like, well, no, they're not just a stupid racist, but they will do all the mental gymnastics they have to, you know, defend the fat orange idiot that they voted for.
Yes! It's amazing to me. And I have this inner, like, dialogue with myself or argument all the time about how, You really do. You really do, to be sort of like a healthy person emotionally and mentally, have to understand that two things can be true. Like, you can love your family even though they're a big giant pile of racists, right? Like, those two things can be true. And then I'm constantly hearing the argument too that, like, not a justification, but sort of a rationalization for why people so vehemently defend Trump and, like, you know, and just, and, you know, and the argument that I often hear is, like, they're not stupid people, they're not bad people. And while objectively I agree with that, it is so hard for me sometimes to understand how you can defend so vehemently someone and not be just, like, a little not smart. You know what I mean? Like, just kind of, like, you really have to question, like, how that person can both be an intelligent person but also really, really think, like, I mean, and I hear the same things for, like, anti-vaxxers. Like, back when there was, like, a huge measles outbreak in Washington last year or whatever.
Oh, yeah, I remember
even,
that.
Even people on NPR were like, these people aren't dumb. They're not uneducated. I'm like, I'm sorry. It's so hard for me to swallow that when, like, there's only mountains of scientific evidence that say, like, you should vaccinate, and there's no scientific evidence for saying you're not. And to say, like, you're not uneducated and you're not unintelligent, it's hard for my brain to, like, make those two things be true.
Oh, yeah. Again, I've never unfriended any of those people because I have to optimistically believe that, well, reason and compassion have to win out at some point, right? Like, there has to be some piece of information or some experience this person has where they're going to be like, oh, yeah, we shouldn't treat immigrants like animals.
Yeah.
Like, and maybe that's just because these things are so obvious to me. It's like, you know, there just has to be that, you know, there's some sort of golden key with everyone that, and yeah, too, I have seen it turn around with people.
Okay. That's cool.
Like, I mean, this guy that was one of my neighbors growing up, I mean, he was, you know, Mr. Conservative Christian Bush supporter, and, you know, now he's an angry Democratic Socialist like most of my other friends. Because at some point in when this guy was in his early 40s, just something clicked. And that's, I don't know, you have to believe that the rabbit hole is never too deep that people can't dig out of it.
Ugh, I love that optimism. Like, I feel like I'm an optimistic person, but that even goes beyond, like, mine, and I love that. I think, too, because I come from a long line of very, very stubborn or very, very fragile egoed people. And so even if their minds do get changed, they almost will never admit it openly, or they will never, they'll still vehemently defend things they don't even believe in anymore to save face. So I think that's where my partial pessimism comes into all of that.
Yeah. Well, and I don't know, I always try and strike that balance between knowing that things are potentially very terrible, but, you know, if you give in to that and just assume it all the time, I mean, you know, depression plays into it too, because, I mean, I'm always on the lookout for, you know, if I follow this train of thought, I'm going to get in, you know, one of those states of mind where I don't want to leave my house for a week. And so it's like, yeah, I mean, you can't necessarily bullshit yourself, but...
Yeah, no, I mean, optimism for me is like a life preserver, I think, in a lot of ways, because if I feel myself trying to go down, like, a path of just, like, how can these people think vaccines are going to kill you or make you sick or be bad for you, then I start to get, like, down a path of despair where I feel like I can't pull myself out of it. Just, it goes into a place where I feel like the dark is sort of sucking me in, and that's where I have to, like, reel back a little bit and just be like, okay, well, maybe they'll change their minds at some point, or maybe someone will educate them, or maybe someone, like, and it's just such a hard line to walk, I think, between saying, like, people are just going to believe what they want to believe and you have to let it go, and saying, like, you know, but how can people, like, you know, stay in this mentality for so long?
Yeah, it's like, I don't know, I'm trying to remember, I feel like it's a quote from something, but I remember someone saying, the world can't stay this way forever.
Yeah.
And, of course, there's a part of me that's like, oh no, this is just where we're at. Like, this is where society is, you know. The people who are wrong have enough voices telling them they're right. It's like, I don't know, one of the first things I saw on Facebook this morning was this guy posting an article from the New York Post saying, you know, Bernie Sanders is a hardcore communist. And it's like, you know, I could just find an article right now that says, well, he actually isn't. It's like, yeah, now we both have our own sources. And
yeah, we have articles. Yay!
Yeah. Of course, the thing is, this guy is always going to go to, like, the New York Post and Fox News for his information, and I'm going to get my information from, you know, people who are right.
Yeah, I mean, do you find, like, I find it fascinating, like, you, me, Josh Morrow, there's a bunch of us that grew up in, like, rural, remote areas, but then we all have sort of these more progressive, like, ideals. Like, where does yours come from?
Well, I mean, it mostly comes from my parents, and two, West Virginia was a lot more progressive when I was growing up than it is.
No way, really?
Yeah, well, I mean, for one thing, I mean, West Virginia was a blue state right up till 2000, and
wow.
I don't know, and as far as, like, social issues went, I mean, people just didn't care as much either. Like, I mean, you know, growing up in a family that was involved in the performing arts and theater,
yeah.
It's like, you know, my parents always had friends who were gay and it just wasn't a thing.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe that was just, you know, my circle of people there too, but
yeah.
I mean, that's kind of another reason that, you know, there's people from back then who have, yeah, become diehard Trump supporters that, you know, I haven't cut off because, like, well, I remember growing up, you know, you didn't talk like this.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think too, maybe because my immediate circle, you know, my family and all of my parents' friends tend to be more progressive, I grew up believing that the rest of the world was more like that.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, my dad was involved in all the activism of the 60s and, you know, and even, like, my mom's family, who were, like, registered Republicans and typical conservative white people, like, even they came around. I mean, that's the joke I like to make is even my token racist uncle voted for Obama twice.
Oh, nice.
And, you know, thinks Trump is an asshole.
Yeah.
So it's like, I mean, even people who weren't necessarily ones you'd consider to be on the front lines of progressivism were, you know, reasonable and compassionate when it came down to it.
Yeah.
Do you find, like, because of the whole negativity bias, it just seems like more people are, like, insane Trump supporters that are, like, racist and sexist?
I like to think that, yeah. And I think, too, part of it is, and again, you come back to the whole mental gymnastics thing where they will go through whatever thought process they have to convince themselves that he's not, you know, racist and sexist, just so they can still feel good about supporting him, because, I don't know, I've read a bit, too, about just the psychology of, you know, different political ideologies, and they'll believe whatever they have to win. I mean, that's part of the reason they are winning, too, is, I mean, back in 2016, no matter what came out about Trump, they still all rallied around him.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, I think people on the left try and be a little more discerning.
Yeah.
And, I mean, there were people that, you know, when they looked at Hillary, it's like, you know, she supported this crime bill back in the 90s, she supported Iraq, she supported all these terrible things in the past. I mean, I went ahead and voted for her just in the interest of not crashing the plane into the mountain,
exactly,
as I like to say.
Yeah.
But a lot of people were like, yeah, no, fuck this, we have to do better.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what we're seeing again, like, and now I do think the media is conflating this whole feud between Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren.
I do too.
But,
yeah.
I mean, it is a fact we are more discerning because it's like, yeah, it is a problem that someone was in support of some pretty, you know, problematic things until fairly recently. And yeah, they have to be accountable for that. And
so with all this said, I mean, you seem to have very, very clear, straightforward sort of thoughts and ideas on politics and things like that. But I don't often hear you espousing these. So would you say you're a hoarder of thoughts?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Big time.
Yeah.
I mean, that's part of why, again, this comes back to me being diplomatic when I go into these things, is that, I mean, I have all these things that I've read and all these, you know, different views I've come to over time. And, you know, the process of coming to that is still very fresh in my mind, too. Yeah. And I'm trying to think how to put this. Like, yeah. I mean, this part's going to sound bad, but I mean, I do even go so far as, oh gosh, what if me and my friends and everyone I admire are actually wrong, and the world is this scary place where, you know, terrorists are coming for us at every turn, and, you know, fuck whoever we have to mistreat to stop that.
Yeah.
And
it's probably good. I mean, it's good, like, because you, when you hang on to things, like, I just literally say whatever immediately I think, which is really bad. Like, I have no, like, there's very few filters that go between here and here. Like, it's just kind of like, I think something, and then I'm like, hey, you know what's great? Like, and I'll just, like, say something out loud. So I imagine when you're sort of hanging on to your thoughts, it's allowing you to process them a lot more before they get put out into the world.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it makes my mind feel insanely cluttered at times, too.
Sure.
I mean, that's what, I mean, sometimes I'll go silent on Facebook for days or weeks at a time, and then, you know, I'll have an evening where I'm just sitting at my apartment drinking, and I'll just unleash all of it.
And how do you unleash? I mean, do you unleash it all on social media? Do you write it down? Do you talk to someone?
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, sometimes there's people that I can have conversations with, like, I mean, calling my mom or my brother is always a good outlet. You know, it helps I have a roommate to talk to now, of course. But, it's funny, recently when I was talking to my brother, actually, he said, yeah, one of the ways I can tell that you've been drinking is when you make a really long, eloquent Facebook post. Because and, you know, I proofread and I remain articulate.
You do. They're never incoherent. They're always well written.
But yeah, I mean, that's kind of where, you know, the dam bursts, and it's like, okay, I need to, now that I've stumbled upon the definitive, all-encompassing feelings I have about this issue, there it is. And, you know, then too, like, I mean, I'm also much more likely to argue with people as well.
Yeah.
I
mean, do you find, like, does it affect your relationships when you maybe hoard your thoughts or hold on to them and don't just communicate things?
Well, yeah, I mean, in certain cases, yeah. I mean, especially, like, I don't know, for the past, like, year and a half since I've been single, knowing how to approach potential relationships, that's become a whole process, because, I don't know, just the process of meeting people is weird, so most people I've been interested in have been people I was already friends with, and that makes it difficult to approach, because it's like, well, do I want to pursue something here, or do I want to just keep enjoying being friends with this person and not change anything? And, yeah, I mean, there's, you know, been a couple of times where it's like, you know, why complicate things if, you know, I'm already good with the way things are?
Yeah, for sure. I have that, like, that's a huge thing of mine, is that I, for a while, was systematically ruining every one of my friendships by sleeping with friends, and so it freaked me the hell out. So I totally get that. And then, you know, I guess on the flip side, do you find, like, you wish you hadn't held back? You wish you sort of would have put more out? You know what I mean?
Only once. Okay. Well, I mean, well, there was one time, too, where basically a friend of mine I was considering asking out just kind of got it out of me and was like, you know, I really would have preferred you'd been more straightforward about this. And it's like, yeah, I understand, but, you know, I would have preferred not bringing it up at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I think that situation's all right, though, but there is one time where this person actually moved halfway around the world without me ever saying anything about this.
Whoa.
And because the day I was going to say something about it was also the day that before I could, she confided to me that she was moving halfway around the world. So it was kind of like, and that's one of those times where I can't help but laugh, like, you know, this is a very Nick Yurick thing to have happen. And, you know, I never said anything because it's like, you know, this person has come to a very important life decision, and I don't feel like a potential relationship with me is worth derailing it over.
Yeah, no, that's smart. I mean, I think that's really, really, I think, rare in a lot of people right now, especially our age, is that, I don't know, you just, you seem to process things. When you hang on to them more, you seem to take more time to process, like, the overall implications of it, which I really find fascinating.
Yeah, well, and, you know, I decided, too, that I wanted the last couple of months I had to hang out with this person to just be us enjoying the last couple of months that we were going to be living on the same continent without, like, this whole added factor to it.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And that's, would you say you've ever found yourself doing anything, do you ever find there are moments where you're completely impetuous and you just do stuff instinctively?
If I drink enough, yes.
Okay.
But, I don't know. It's weird, like, when you've had a relationship for so long, there is such a learning curve to getting back into that frame of mind.
Yeah.
And I mean, yeah, there have been a couple of times where I'd meet someone and it's like, you know what? Let's just go for it and see what happens. But
in general, do you find yourself ever behaving impetuously? Like, not just specific to relationships, or is everything pretty well, like, you hang on to it, you process it, and then you act?
Yeah, anymore now, I mean, and that's partly too, because I was a really impulsive kid, and I think that by the time I was in college, I started to realize that that was becoming a problem, and, you know, I mean, my parents had really warned me about that my whole time growing up, too, so I think that I just worked all the impulsivity out of myself at a pretty young age, for the most part.
Okay. You are a very hilarious and valued member of the Sad Boy Social Club sketch group, which is one of the top sketch groups in Cleveland. do you ever find yourself wanting to hoard ideas that you have for sketch to yourself to use for something else, or does it all get contributed to the group?
Yeah, there's a lot of things that, I don't know, first off, I've kept every notebook I've ever written anything comedy-wise
okay.
in, and plus
okay.
there's like a running, you know, notes document on my phone, and yeah, there's a lot of stuff I'll hold on to that's like, you know, is this a stand-up premise, or is this a Sad Boys sketch, and
Yeah. Of
course there's some stuff too, you know, there's something I talk about a lot with Drew Mulkins, who's also in the Sad Boys, because me and him were roommates for 3 years, way before Sad Boys, and a lot of sketches have come from just ideas that we used to talk about sitting around the house that's like, you know, this may be too big for a stand-up premise, but it's got to be something, and, you know, now doing sketch comedy, we've found a home for a lot of those ideas, and
yeah.
I mean, that's why you hold on to them, because, again, you never know when you're going to get that thing that's is the exact right place to put it.
Yep. That's a big thing that we've been finding a lot is, like, we constantly have these little ideas for things, and because, like, Adam and I will write together, and then we have a third writing partner that we write with sometimes, and we always have these little piece things that are hilarious. But it's like that, it by itself, it's not anything. You know what I mean? So we keep recording and writing down these little pieces and then hoping, like, that's so much of what comedy writing, maybe writing in general, really is just writing down a bunch of little pieces of things that don't exist as anything on their own, but then finding a place to fit it later on when you're writing a sketch or you're writing a short or something like that.
Yeah, and that's kind of the question I've had to start asking when it comes to comedy is, is this something that I can portray just me talking about on stage with a microphone?
Yeah.
Or is this something that people are going to have to see, like, four or five of us acting it out to really get the humor in?
How often do you do stand-up?
Well, I've been kind of taking a step back from it of late. I just recently started writing again. I mean, I try and go out once a week now just to try out new ideas again. I mean, my main focus as far as doing actual shows has been with the Sad Boys lately, but I'm starting to get inspired to, you know, push more on stand-up lately. It's just, I don't know. I've needed to get to a place where my ability to be funny and comfortable on stage isn't dependent on drinking anymore.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, this is something I've been doing for 10 years, and, like, I've gone through periods where I could be really just on it and quick and clever on my own, and, but the thing I realized was happening over the past year is I wasn't putting so much into the writing as I was almost just making it a challenge for myself. Like, so if I, you know, go to an open mic with one premise in mind, I'll have a few drinks and go on stage and see where the premise goes. And I got some good sets out of it, but again, this kind of goes against my memory hoarding instinct because I wasn't able to remember why they were good.
Yeah, I get that a lot too. Like, I feel like my problem is I write so much while I'm high now, and I get so much gold, like so much gold when I'm high. But then there are also things where, like, your brain just really wants you to think that everything you write is genius when you're high. And so I'll go back later and just be like, whoa, I don't know what that was about. Like, Twitter especially, like, I tweet, like, up a tweet storm. Like, just everything that I think, basically. Like, it's just all, like, everything where I'm just like, this is gold. And then I go back later and I have no likes. And I'm like, wait, why didn't anybody think this was funny? And then I start rereading it and I'm like, wow, I don't know what I was thinking there. Like, I don't know what that was about.
Oh, yeah, I've had that happen a lot, too, and, I mean, there's notes that I have in my phone that I could probably find right now where it's like, oh, this was so funny to me when I was high and to the other people who were high with me, but now it's, like, not anything now.
Gigi said this happened last night.
Yeah, Jess and I were just, like, hanging out in the hot tub last night, and I was telling her about, like, my New Year's Eve antics, because as a 30-year-old woman, I got blackout drunk for the first time in my life. So, it just led into this discussion of, like, people's drunk alter egos, like, different personalities, and then I just started, and I also was hashtag high, but I was like, I want to name every single version of my drunk alter ego.
Yeah.
Like, starting from the most basic, like, just barely have a buzz to that blackout situation that happened, and I did it, and then I came inside and just kept writing, like, full descriptions. It almost sounds like a horoscope.
It does, yeah.
But, yeah.
It's almost like if you take a BuzzFeed quiz, it's like, which Hannah are you?
Yeah.
And then you get one, and it's like, you're, you know, Poppy. Everybody loves you, and you're super flirty, and, like, it's just, it's literally like one of those BuzzFeed quizzes. And what's funny is, like, there's probably a lot of shit in there that we were like, that's hilarious, and we'll go back and read and be like, what the hell? But there was a lot of shit in there that was also legitimately hilarious.
It's pretty funny just because, like, it's the truth at the end of the day, so it's like, that's not going to change. It's just stupid and ridiculous.
Exactly. That reminds me of the show Brooklyn Nine-Nine. I don't know if you guys have watched that. The character Amy, there's, like, different versions of her depending on how many drinks she's had.
Yeah!
That's essentially what it was.
Yes. I did just find one of my high ideas that. What's funny is this one actually. This ended up turning into. I wrote a sketch about what a stupid idea this was that the rest of the group really liked, but at the time it was initially conceived, this was, I'm trying to think, this was I think way back last spring, because it was before Jeremy moved back and rejoined the group, but yeah, like the four of us that were here, we were all high and talking about different things to do with the album that we're about to put out, and like we were talking about different bumpers we could have between, you know, the different sketches on the album. And I had this idea for, well, we could make like a variety show with a, you know, a guy named Host Hostington who's hosting the variety show. And then between every sketch, he dies, and then one of his brothers shows up and hosts. And, yeah, we could make it all about the Hostington brothers. And no one liked the idea at the time, but I kept coming back to it, you know, because I was high, and again, I was hoarding the idea. And kind of the joke of the evening ended up being, you know, why did Nick go all in on this hosting dinner? Anyway, like, then a month or two ago, again, I was still hoarding the thing, and it's like, well, what if I wrote a sketch about me having this stupid idea, but then there's a flash forward to this stupid idea going on to become a successful variety show? And so, yeah, I did. I wrote a script for it, and it went over very well in table readings, so that might be coming to a Sad Boys show near you in the future.
Yay!
The sketch in which Nick goes all in on the Hostington brothers.
I love, too, the thing about writing where, like, if something doesn't work, you can take it up a level to, like, a meta level where you're, like,
yeah.
you're just, the joke is how dumb the thing is that you came up with. And then,
oh, yeah.
And if that doesn't work, you can take it up, like, another weird level, and it becomes just this, like, it can always evolve, which I love.
Well, yeah, because sometimes an idea that in itself isn't funny, the joke is how unfunny this is.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, then you get a scene where, you know, the year is 2050 and the stupid idea is one of the most popular shows on network TV.
Yeah. Or like so there was a show I feel like a lot of people have watched. I tried watching it. It's called I Think You Should Leave. And it's on Netflix.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, so I've been trying, like, Adam watches it, and he thinks it's hilarious. I have seen, like, a couple episodes, and I'm like, okay, like, this is funny. But for the most part, it almost all seems like one great big inside joke of, like, how dumb can we make something? And, like, the fact that, like, we made this really stupid thing that, like, no one should think is funny, and then they just double down on, like, the stupidity more and more and more and more to a point where it's just, like, it becomes funny because it almost is, like, this self-aware, like, we're just going to make this stupider and less sensical, like, the more we go through this sketch. And I don't know, that's just what when I started looking at it from a, like, oh, this isn't meant to make any sense. This isn't any, like, I had to do that with Seinfeld recently. Like, I was like, I have to stop looking at this, like, these characters should be, like, relatable, and look at it, like, Always Sunny, where it's like, oh, no, these people are all terrible, and then it's much more funny to watch it that way.
Yeah.
Just a bunch of hot messes.
Yeah.
It's funny you mentioned Seinfeld, too, because, yeah, like, the concept of the show being about nothing, I mean, yeah, like, that gets taken a lot further when you just double down on the absurdism.
Yeah.
It's like, no, this is about less than nothing.
Yeah.
This is about, yeah.
I think, like, for me, what was the easiest part of getting my head wrapped around that show was especially early on. Like, they did it really early on where, you know, they ended up trying to sell a pilot to NBC about a show about nothing, and they were all just hanging out. And, like, when it all started becoming so self-aware, that was the thing. I just didn't remember it being self-aware, and I think that was primarily just because I was, like, 8 and didn't understand self-awareness, or even that show when it was out. But, like, the fact that I realized, like, they reference at one point, like, how Jerry's just a really bad actor in the show, and I was like, oh, thank God, they know. Like, they know he's terrible, yeah. And he knows he's terrible. Like, everybody knows that. Like, it just, it puts, like, a different spin on the whole thing, where, like, oh, okay, they know. Like, they know how absurd this is, and how nobody should be watching it, and how it makes no sense, and how Jerry's a bad actor, and how, like, Elaine has horrible hair. Like, they know all of this. They're fully aware of, like, those things, and it made it so much easier for me to watch.
Well, I mean, that's part of what's fun about, like, I don't know, people talk about, like, you know, writing to your strengths. It's also fun to write to your weaknesses and acknowledge them. It's like, I mean, that's what's fun about, I mean, some of the sketches we write, you know, we are playing specific characters, and then there's some where it's just like, you know, we're fictionalized versions of ourselves, and...
Yep. Yeah, I think it's good. A theme that I've been trying to, like, that I've been relating to a lot with lately, and it's been coming up a lot on the show, is, like, how you can sort of take awkwardness, or you can take, like, uncomfortableness, or you can take anything that feels weird, and when you just name it or you say it out loud, it almost, like, deflates it immediately. Like, you're just kind of like, oh, my God, this situation is so awkward right now. And then it just almost puts a stop to it, because then everyone becomes like, oh, my God, someone else was thinking that, too. You know what I mean? Like, how much you can take the air out of uncomfortable situations.
Well, yeah, and I think kind of getting over that hump of, yeah, this is so weird and awkward and should never be shared with humanity at large, only exist in my hoarder brain. I mean, it's kind of how you find yourself to be less alone, I think, is, yeah, when you do go out there, it's like, oh, no, this stuff is living in other people's brains, too.
Oh, yeah, a whole, like, that's the thing I love, and I know you as an actor probably get this, too. Like, acting has been so cathartic for me, because people really do have to sit around and talk about their feelings and their experiences and shit like that to get to a good place to become, like, a, you know, proficient actor. And, like, I was telling her, I'm in a Meisner technique class right now. And,
oh, nice.
And all we've been doing for 4 weeks, or for 8 classes, or whatever the fuck we've been doing, is he makes somebody, like, there's 40 people in the class. Each person has to go up in front of the room for 10 minutes, and he basically interviews them about, like, their, you know, worst moments of their lives, their biggest fears, their dreams, their hopes, like, all that stuff. And there is literally almost, like, everybody has the same 5 things. Like, of 40 people, everybody's got the same 5 things that it really boils down to that they're worried about, that upsets them, that they've experienced. And there are things that, like, if you, you know, you've probably thought to yourself, like, no one else thinks and feels this way, but then you go and you sit in front of 40 people and they're all just like, yeah, shit, that's exactly how I feel about it. You know what I mean? So.
Well, that's, it's funny. That's kind of become one of the things that's been really special about, you know, running a summer theater now, because there's so many people that either, you know, they're young and just starting out, or it's like their first professional job, and so you get to see a lot of those people, yeah, have that experience for the first time, being around people that are open about all that stuff, and yeah, like, I mean, I think that's why the sense of community among a group of actors is so strong, because, I mean, they can't do the job without putting themselves out there in that way, basically.
Right, and that's the thing, like, you know, anybody that was even remotely reticent about going up and talking, you know, that you could see it hit them where they were just like, I don't know that I want to talk about this or that. And before the instructor could even say it, they were like, you could see the realization of like, oh, I see, this is what I have to do if this is what I want to do. Then eventually, and there really wasn't anybody who, like, refused to do it. They were just kind of like, okay, I get it now. This is what I'm supposed to be doing, and I have to be vulnerable and all that shit. So, yeah, I mean, that's what I absolutely love about acting. And it's so cool that you have that summer theater that you run. It's down in West Virginia, right?
Yep. That's back in my hometown of Beckley. Yeah, we do historical dramas and musicals down there. And it's cool because, I mean, I basically grew up around that theater. It's actually where my parents met back in the 70s. And, I don't know, like, I had taken some time off from it then, you know, the summer after my dad passed in 2016. It's like, you know, this, if nothing else, this will be an excuse to spend a couple months around my family. And then I just kind of got reinvested in it. And, yeah, it is really rewarding. Oh, it's interesting, too, you know, you brought up acting techniques. I've become such a fan of Meisner just because, well, for a lot of reasons, but the time I got into it, it seemed so different from, like, the technique we learned a lot when I was a freshman in college was Stanislavski, which, it's interesting, this ties back around to the whole hoarding thing, because that's very big on emotional memory and sense memory, and so yeah, at that time, and you know, looking back, it maybe kind of, it led to some unhealthy mental practices, because, yeah, like, at that time, my first year of college, you know, I'm going through the breakup of my first, like, serious relationship, and that on top of just adjusting this new phase in my life, and also, too, realizing that, depression was very real. It wasn't just something that, you know, it wasn't just me being a miserable kid like I thought I was.
Yeah.
And, I mean, at that time, though, as I'm learning, you know, sense memory is an acting technique, I took it as, oh, I need to hold on to all of this because I'm going to need to use it in a performance someday.
Yup. And that's the thing I learned, too, very quickly, is that holding on to that stuff, we were talking about how that drags you sometimes back down into despair. And I even remember telling my therapist, like, I'm worried because I worry that if I tap into an emotion or sense memory that gets me to a bad place for, you know, a performance, then I'm not going to be able to get out of that. And my one teaching instructor was like, oh, yeah, that's what we call Heath Ledgering. Don't do that. Like, you don't want to, like, put yourself in a place that, like, you are actually feeling the things. You just want to experience them, sort of thing. So I think that's a really great point, is you can't really hoard that or hang on to it if you're not great about it. Especially if you've suffered from depression, you don't want to drag yourself back down that hole. So
yeah. Well, it's funny now, because as a director, that's where I find myself in the position of explaining to young actors, like, no, don't go all in on this, because we need you to be a person when you get off stage.
Exactly. One of the coolest exercises we ever did, and I think I told you about it, was that we had to think about, like, someone we loved, and then we had to do some sort of, like, physical action. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I was thinking about you, and then they were like, okay, think about that person dying. They made me. I didn't want to. And
that's okay.
And then when I thought about you dying, they were like, okay, now picture that person after their death. Like, what's the one thing you'd want to do? And I, like, hugged you, and then I started bawling, like, uncontrollably bawling. And then she was like, okay, now immediately turn to, like, literally, she was like, okay, turn to the person next to you, and she's like, tell them, like, something really embarrassing that you've done recently or the funniest joke you know. Do it right now. And so, like, this girl and I turned to each other. We were both talking about, like, stupid shit that had happened to us lately. And, like, we're both crying, but we're laughing. And she's like, okay, that's what you have to do. You have to, like, think about the hardest, most sad, horrible thing that happens to you. And then the director's going to yell, cut. And you have to, like, go to the rap party and, like, be a normal human being now. And
you have to be able to jump right out of it.
And I was like, holy shit, that's amazing. Like, I never even thought about that. But, like, knowing that you have that ability to do it, too. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. And again, it's a tough balance of mental health that you strike with that stuff, too. And
yeah, I mean, acting, I mean, we all, the fun part about being a performer entertainer is that we all kind of already wear our hearts on our sleeves, and we all have, like, these, like, very emotional tendencies. It's just, I think it's more just the act of learning how to, like, regulate it more, really, rather than just either letting it all out or holding it all in, just learning how to keep it at, you know, sort of this medium distance. Hey, so where can we find the next Sad Boys Social Club sketch, show, times, dates, all that stuff?
The next show we currently have lined up is going to be March 28th. It's going to be at the Center in Akron. Yeah, we also have an album that should be coming out later this spring. We're in the process of final edits and mastering on it. It's called Sad to the Bone.
Sweet.
And yeah, that'll be available on I believe we're going to do iTunes and Spotify, but yeah, you can check our page on Facebook, Sad Boys Social Club, for updates on all of that. But yeah, those are kind of the two main things we've got in the works right now. Of course, you can also check our YouTube channel. We're, you know, usually putting out new videos every couple months.
They're hilarious.
That's right. Yeah, you were in one of them.
I was gonna say, I'm not just saying that because I was in one. All of their sketches are hilarious.
We do try. Yep.
I actually put that sketch in my film reel, my acting reel. So when I go to apply for jobs, people see that sketch.
Really?
Yeah, because I was like, I loved it. The video was like such good quality. It was a hilarious scene. It didn't need an explanation because like I was just yelling, "We're not together. You're a fucking psycho. Quit stalking me." And then I like ran away. So you know, I love what you guys do. You do such a good job of it. Is there anything independently you've got to promote, like shows or anything coming up?
Well, if you ever are passing through West Virginia this summer, stop by Theater West Virginia out at Grandview National Park. It's a beautiful outdoor amphitheater. We'll be doing two historical dramas in June. It's actually our 60th season down there. Then we're also, for the first time, putting on a production of Hairspray the Musical the first couple weeks of July. And we're actually bringing back one of our original shows, Rocket Boys the Musical, at the end of July, which is based on the same story of the film October Sky. So, yeah, doing a lot of varied things in varied places right now.
You got a lot of irons in the fire.
Yeah. I've also got a murder mystery coming up on the Cuyahoga Valley Scenic Railroad. You can go to mykillerparty.com for information on those shows. It's fun, improv-based murder mystery that involves a lot of audience participation.
You are holding back. You are hoarding all kinds of shit that you do. Holy shit.
Yeah, you know, that's day-to-day, I feel like I have a pretty mundane life, but then, you know, when I'm actually asked about, it's like, oh, well, looking at my calendar. Yep,
me too. Yeah. I'm like, I'm boring as fuck. And people are like, are you on the side of a building in New York? And I'm like, I mean, I guess, probably. I don't know. Some weird-ass shit. Geech, do you have any social media?
Yeah, you can find me on Instagram at g.g.chick.
You can find me at epicfaul, E-P-I-C-F-A-U-L, Instagram and Twitter. You can find us on the default setting pod. I want to thank OK Pants for doing our logo and Above Below Entertainment for being our network. And I want to thank Nick Yurek so much for being our guest today.
Well, thank you for having me. This was fun.
This was super fun. You're amazing. I love listening to you talk. You have so many interesting things to say. And OK, love you. Bye.
Bye.